MENA Watch, der Talk.
Sehr geehrte Zuseherinnen und Zuseher, herzlich willkommen bei diesem MENA Watch Talk. Es ist uns heute eine große Freude, wieder Rabbi Abraham Cooper vom Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles zu Gast zu haben. Rabbi Cooper ist auch derzeit Vorsitzender der Kommission der Vereinigten Staaten für internationale Religionsfreiheit. Wir werden da auch sicher auf einiges zu sprechen kommen, was mit dieser Arbeit im Zusammenhang steht. Wir hatten im vergangenen November schon die Gelegenheit, mit Rabbi Cooper zu sprechen, und wir sind natürlich sehr gespannt, mit ihm über einige der Dinge zu reden, die sich seit letzten November getan haben. So, Rabbi Cooper, I'm very pleased that we have the opportunity to talk to each other again. The last time we saw each other, it was in mid-November, and quite a lot has changed and happened since yes. then, not least in the USA. So, in November, we talked about what's going on in American universities after the Hamas massacre in Israel in October. And since then, the problem has worsened dramatically. There have been occupations of campus grounds and university buildings. Anti-Israel students were marching through the streets in LA, as well as I read and saw. There have been anti-Semitic incidents in numerous places with chants expressing solidarity with Hamas and calling for Tel Aviv to be burned down to the ground. Jewish students at Columbia University were told to go back to Poland, and there were other numerous incidents like that. Did you think that something like that would ever be possible in the United States?
I think that anyone who would say that they're not surprised is not being honest. I think there are a number of points. First, as you know, this is about the fifth round between Israel and Hamas, although having just been last week in the communities that were devastated, that was a military level invasion with input and help from entities and countries well beyond Hamas's capability. But in the last round, there was an attempt by Hamas supporters to export the Hamas hatred to the outside world, again, starting in Germany. The following Friday, you may recall that a number of SUVs in London, driven by Hamas supporters, actually screamed on the bullhorn, we're going to come back and rape your mothers and daughters. That horrible quote, which in some ways now actually did take place October 7th, but it was repeated in North America the following week. So you saw, maybe for the first time, the kind of effort to export the Hamas narrative, maybe with limited results. But after October 7th, the scope of what was done, obviously with the help of platforms on social media, especially Telegram, TikTok, an easy place to start. The ferocity and the speed with which this hatred not only was transmitted, but was embraced and promoted was really shocking. The next shock to the system was the general failure of university presidents and administrators to intervene. From the point of view of the Jewish communities in the United States and in Canada, it wasn't really an issue because this was no longer a debate about two-state solution, where the borders will be, is East Jerusalem going to be Palestinian, etc. It's all gone. Wake up one morning, and there's no debate about a two-state solution. They want it all, from the river to the sea. Openly, aggressive, sometimes not only intimidation and bullying, not only violence and destroying university property, but bullying and intimidation and sometimes violence against Jewish students and threats against others. And by the way, which has also spread into the business communities, where we get calls now from people who are accomplished, who are in corporation settings, and who find themselves targeted by anti-Semitism with little or no responsiveness on the part of the corporate structure. So we have a huge problem, which was not anticipated. There are many moving parts to this, and maybe after that we'll take the next question. What we do now know, largely through the work of ISCAP, Dr. Charles Small and his team, they have been investigating, I think, for at least 2 years, the specifics of the $4 billion investment of Qatar into elite universities in the United States. Cornell, for example, alone got north of millions of dollars. That piece of the equation was not known. Of course, we knew of investments by, you know, Saudi Arabia, even the UAE, but there are also other countries. There's Turkey, there's China. But that the Qatar, which had masked a lot of its more insidious behavior behind the image of some sort of honest broker, actually was the main player in planting the seeds and setting the stage for a silent reaction on the part of the universities to what was coming down. And that was another devastation. I think one other point, especially as we're talking about a think tank, we talk about watching the university presidents, or even more recently, you had more hearings in the U.S. Congress, let's say, in which the head of the City University of New York and other schools, including elementary school systems in Oakland, California. You see the spread of this. And when we watched the reaction of the MIT and Columbia and Harvard presidents, the mouths that were moving were presidents of elite universities. The words were written by lawyers. And I don't know about Europe, but I can say the following about the situation in the United States. We don't need lawyers, we need leadership. Many of the universities have either lost or abandoned their moral GPS. And this is a time, if you want to talk about learning lessons from the Holocaust and the Wannsee Conference and all the rest, this is a time when universities need moral leadership. We need people with some courage to take currently unpopular steps in order to reclaim their right to be called an elite institution of higher learning.
Taking unpopular steps certainly included clearing the university grounds of these occupiers. I guess, as far as we hear from you, that's the right decision by them to take from your point of view, I guess.
Well,
what do you say of those people who say that there's freedom of expression at stake here?
There are a couple of points. First of all, complete nonsense. So happens, we're talking, actually, I'm in Vienna. And yesterday I had a very impressive hour and a half session with the Minister of Education, who was leaving his phone on because at the University of Vienna, the tents popped up. So things quiet down in Amsterdam. Before Amsterdam, they quieted down a little bit in the West Coast. And you see this campaign somewhere being sort of manipulated in order to keep it going and to test the grounds in different locations. Look, when it's public property, it's relatively simple. The police can come in. There are rules about access for students. You know, there's a contract between a student, usually a parent who pays $90,000 US a year in order for a student to be able to get an education. So when it's in the a state school, then the university anyway has limited rights to say what or should or should not be done in a public domain. Where it gets maybe a bit more complicated is when you have private institutions, and in most cases, the police cannot intervene in a private institution, even though they have their own private police forces, unless they're requested to do so by the university in question. So, for example, at UCLA, and anyone could Google UCLA Jewish student blocked from going to class, the video. You have a kid wearing a Magen David, Jewish star, wants to go to class. His way is blocked by protesters. UCLA is a public institution. On what basis would anyone defend the right of those people blocking a student who has, by contract and by right, he's got to get to class? He can't go in because somebody else doesn't like Jews or Zionists? That there is really no leg to stand on. And more than that, I remember some months ago, probably back in November, maybe right after we spoke, what happened in MIT, which has now been repeated in some other locations, in which protesters created a human chain to block Jewish students from going to class at MIT. And you know what the police, campus police said? Come with us, we'll go around the back, I'll open the door so you can go to class. Instead of telling the people who are blocking the way, excuse my Yiddish, get the hell out of the way and let this guy go, these people go to class, they caved. The signal is this kind of behavior is right. So yes, freedom of expression, freedom of speech is there. But when it's so blatantly obvious that that kind of intervention is asserting rights that are based on robbing the other person of their rights. I'm not a lawyer, but I think whatever the legal system would be, there's not really a lot either ethically or legally to stand on.
You mentioned leadership and the need for leadership. That brings me to, of course, the one who is, certainly most representative of leadership at the moment, U.S. President Joe Biden. Let's move on from the universities to the bigger picture. Biden has announced recently that he will no longer send military supplies to Israel, supplies that could be used in an offensive against the last Hamas battalions in Rafah. Is the president now sacrificing Israel's only hopes of re-election in the fall, or is he caving into the anti-Israel wing of the Democrats, or what is going on there?
Yes,
this is a prudent decision by the president to do?
It certainly is imprudent, especially not for a president who dramatically flew to Israel to tell the people of Israel he had their back, who perhaps beyond Bibi Netanyahu and the inner cabinet has seen more visually of what was done to the innocent civilians, 1,200 innocent civilians plus on October 7th. Frankly, it's not a coherent policy, but we are moving on to the realpolitik. And yet the day before the president made that announcement during a CNN interview, he made a dramatic speech attacking anti-Semitism and acknowledging what was going on the campuses. So I would just say the following. I've been heavily critical of certain European leaders over many years when they would rush to come to Yom HaShoah memorials for dead Jews. And I've always said, if you're not ready to stand for live ones, we don't need you to come to stand in silent memory for dead Jews. We're not there yet in the United States. It would be unfair to categorize what's going on right now. But I think in the political calculus of people around the president of the United States, they may have thought that by timing, of course, Yom HaShoah has just passed, but by timing the delivery of that speech on the eve of making the announcement, which they knew would infuriate Israel, I think in part he thought that would mute somewhat the criticism of American Jews for that decision. And if anything, the proximity of those two statement speeches has inflamed passions even more. This is a serious, we've come to a serious point in the bilateral relations. It comes at the worst possible moment for the Jewish state, meaning Israel can take care of Rafah without any of that stuff, although it might take longer and maybe we'll lose more hostages as a result. I don't know. I'm not a military expert. But more broadly, Israel is fighting a 6 or 7 front war. Pretty much everyone is waiting for the other shoe to drop with Hezbollah. And God forbid if that happens, southern Lebanon and northern Israel will be decimated. It would be horrific, a horrific war. And it would also bring the possibility of direct intervention in Iran. Possible. So, and then we have the Houthis and, you know, what's going on in the West Bank and the noises out of Jordan, et cetera, et cetera. It's the worst possible signal that makes all of the wrong players in the Middle East very happy. So you might say that Joe Biden is in a trap of his own making, with trying to balance things that are not really, frankly, can't be balanced. And Prime Minister Netanyahu is involved in a trap, not of his making, but on the one hand, the deepest desire on the part of the Jewish people and led by the state of Israel and the people of Israel to free the remaining hostages and to recover the remains of those who were killed, those who were taken back into Gaza. I'm very close with the father of one of the 19-year-old soldier who Israel thought the two of the people in his tank were taken alive into Gaza, and only 2 weeks ago learned that their sons had died in Israel, but their remains are there. And I was involved for some time in trying to help the family of Hadar Golden, an Israeli soldier who was killed and whose body was taken back to Gaza, I think almost a decade ago. They're still holding it. So you've got this profound challenge to try to get home the hostages who are still alive. And at the same time, for anyone who knows the details of what happened on the 7th, when Prime Minister Netanyahu looked straight into the camera, I think it was the next day, and said, and we're going to kill every last one of them. He's the first Israeli leader to ever say anything like that. Not during the Six-Day War, not when the surprise attack of the Yom Kippur War, never. But when you realize that you're talking about the equivalent of what, 10 9/11s happening in the course of one day, when you're talking about the murder of 300 plus women, rape and murder, dismemberment, the sexual violence against them, the world, you can't even say the world has forgotten about the women, because the United Nations, with the exception of one brave person, been completely silent on this issue. When you have the special rapporteur on violence against women and girls, I think the initial reaction was, well, we don't know for sure if it really happened. That silence leads to denial. And denial is a weapon. And where Hamas learned how to take denial into a weapon, they learned it, I think, from the Iranians, because the Iranians insist that the Shoah never happened, despite all the evidence, the mountains of evidence. They simply, that state policy, they weaponize all of their, you know, the cultural ministry and their media releases and their major personnel to deny the Shoah, to denigrate the victims. What you learn from there is if you can deny the Holocaust, you can deny anything. And there is the continuum there between the Shoah and what happened on October 7th. And that silence of the UN, Secretary General Guterres's horrible behavior and refusal to even list Hamas, even utter the word of Hamas, as far as I know, there's no official condemnation of Hamas by name, is an abject failure of epic proportions, which in the long range, God forbid, is going to make rape even a bigger weapon of war, and which is degrading the moral force of NGOs who remain silent. Simon Wiesenthal Center wrote to 50 NGO women's NGOs, just asking them to make a statement. We received zero responses.
Yeah. Obviously, what happens with the hostages is one of the main topics in Israel. There have been these huge demonstrations with the slogan, bring them home now. And that's certainly understandable. But the problem to me, and I was at one of these rallies in Tel Aviv, the problem is how. Nobody knows how to do it. I mean, just for Israel to stop the war certainly alone will also not bring back the hostages. So yes, of course, it's true to demand that the hostages come back home, but no one actually knows or can say how to do it.
Right. So while I'm neither a military expert or an expert in any field, I am a parent. I'm a lover of Israel. I have grandchildren, in Israel. But I think to understand the psychosis of the leadership of Hamas that actually forces the only possible means other than surrender and guaranteeing more such horrors that the prime minister and his inner war cabinet, which represent two of his political opponents, there really is no choice. And coming full circle back to your question about President Biden, it's very difficult to fathom what is going through his mind. I believe that there must be people who are communicating with him and have convinced him and maybe Secretary Blinken that somehow there's going to be some a major bloodbath by going into Rafah. With all due respect, and I say it as an American, we've been pretty sloppy when it comes to collateral damage in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, et cetera. And in many of those cases, even with drones, there was a sense that America had no choice. Well, Joe Biden knows that Israel has no choice, not really. And the idea of now sort of upping the ante the U.S. may actually pull back in a more fundamental way from its military alliance and relationship with Israel is a very, very serious moment indeed. And I think at the end of the day, from a political standpoint, it's stupid because the people who support Hamas and hate Israel, whatever he does will never be enough. And for one of the strongest bases of support he has historically, the Democratic Party has historically, the American Jewish community in terms of money, and support and votes, because Jews vote in the United States, there is a level of fury and sort of an incredulity. Is like, what's going on here? Why at the end of this announcement are they cheering in Tehran? Why are you essentially saying, you know, this may give a lifeline to Hamas? The people who are holding our loved ones underground for 7 months, like, it doesn't make any sense. And frankly, because of previous decisions made by the administration, going back to the evacuation of Afghanistan, if you speak to the experts around the world in the military domain, they can't point to any quote unquote, you know, victory for this administration. I don't say it with any glee. I say it with great sorrow. So right now, it's still sort of in no man's land. In terms of political machinations, just if you look up, you know, if you viewers look up, Google Senator Fetterman, F-E-T-T-E-R-M-A-N from Pennsylvania. He is a loyal, classic Democrat. When you see what he's saying on X every day, and what he has told protesters who've come to his office, it's just really very basic. Hamas can have a ceasefire yesterday, just has to lay down its arms. This could all be over yesterday. And yet you have the squad and you have much of the legacy media in the US not doing a very good job of putting in the appropriate context. And one of the terrible byproducts of that is the hostages have been forgotten by too many people, and the death and suffering and humiliation and mutilation of innocent women has not only been forgotten, has essentially been erased by virtue of decisions of omission and sometimes commission by the very people we've entrusted in civil society and international diplomacy to speak up for those victims.
You mentioned legacy media in the United States. Well, the New York Times certainly belonged to this legacy media. There is a New York Times columnist, Thomas Friedman, who is routinely off the mark when it comes to Israel, as far as I'm concerned. But he recently wrote that Israel had to choose between Rafah and Riyadh, meaning Israel would have to forego an offensive against Rafah in favor of normalizing relations with Saudi Arabia.
Right. So,
do you think he has a point here, or is he wrong again?
One of the few consistencies in my life over the decades has been Thomas Friedman's success at selling a lot of books. Was it From Beirut to Jerusalem, or Jerusalem to Beirut, and other books? He is consistently wrong. And I give him credit because it's never stopped him from writing the next book or the next column. Look, I was just in Riyadh as the head of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. I just spent time in the United Arab Emirates for about 10 days. This is all after October 7th. I'm in touch with other activists from the Gulf. I'm not an expert on the Gulf, but I'm not a novice either. And the fundamentals of what MBS wants for his country and haven't changed one bit. He still has an existential threat from Iran. He still has to create jobs for a generation of young people, or they're going to land up being a rich, failed state. Obviously have already working relationships with Israel in areas of security. They certainly don't need a rabbi from Los Angeles to even comment on that. But yes, the amount of time that this has been taking is a shock to the region. But at the core and at the base, nothing has changed. in terms of how a person like that would view the world. There could be others in the region for whom they have to worry more about their street. They may not have that kind of clout, you know, to hold things together, but the fundamentals are all there. And I would say, I'm not quoting anyone, no one said it to me explicitly, but I would change the headline a little bit to get back to Riyadh, finish with Rafah, get past this, and you'll see how fast things can mend. And it does need mending. And the Gaza needs mending, and our people need mending. But the notion that you have to choose between the two is just more political posturing by a person who's had a platform for decades. And while I'd love to be able to see someone like that be right, he's dead wrong on this occasion.
You mentioned your recent visit to Saudi Arabia. You made kind of headlines when you were in Saudi Arabia in March. Tell us a little bit about what happened there.
Yeah, well, I'm currently the chair of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. The Saudis approved a visit by the commission. They insisted that only the top two people come. So I'm the chair, my vice chair, a wonderful friend of mine. We have nothing in common politically. Pastor Fred Davey, a graduate of the Union Theological Seminary and African American, wonderful, wonderful person. So we went. And on the first day of the visit, we had very good meetings scheduled. We had an outstanding 2-hour meeting with the president of the Saudi Arabian Human Rights Commission, a woman who could be the prime minister of any country, as far as I'm concerned. Brilliant, 30 different subjects, knew her stuff cold, and 6 other people in the group. But in front of us was a woman who was representing Saudi Arabia on sensitive issues. That evening, we were the guests of the foreign ministry at a place called Diriyah. It's a UNESCO site, sort of like showing the ancient Riyadh and et cetera. Lovely place. And we saw some films historically about the region. And about, I would say, 20 or 25% through the tour, I was told I had a phone call. I was told that, you know, Rabbi, we have laws in Saudi Arabia, and we don't care what you do in private, but in public, you cannot show any religious symbol except the Islamic symbols. So please take off your kippah. So my reaction was, well, it's like asking a Saudi woman to remove her hijab. It's not a political statement. This is who I am. I'm a rabbi. And I said, besides, 50 years ago, I spent a month in the Soviet Union. I didn't take it off for them, and I'm sure not taking it off for you. But are you really sure that you want me to take it off? Because I'm the head of a U.S. government delegation that's here to investigate and report on religious freedom. So he checked, called me back 10 minutes later and said, you either take off your kippah, you have to leave. If you don't leave, you'll be escorted out. And so at which point I said, I'm leaving, but I'm also leaving because I can't do my job here. So I'll be leaving Saudi Arabia. And now, while I gave my colleagues the freedom to choose to stay, it was unanimous, and we were to leave. I later had a phone call from a high-ranking Saudi diplomat overseas, and who said, you know, I hope you'll stay, but maybe it's better it happened to you, because it's about time we stop sweeping such incidents under the rug. So what I understood from that 90 seconds was that, number one, the call that I got wasn't instigated from MBS or anyone associated with him. I think it reflected people who are just shocked by the kinds of changes that are going on, especially with the women, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm not the first person to say no. I'm not the first person to be asked, but I may be the first person who said no. And I asked the various Saudis who I would speak to before I left, you're talking about 2030, there's a new Saudi Arabia, et cetera. So, well, what kind of Saudi Arabia are you going to market? If you want Christian and Jewish tourists to come, you're going to ask a tourist who's wearing a cross around her neck that she has to hide it, or to tell Orthodox Jews from New York, put on your Mets cap so that everybody will know you're an Orthodox Jew from New York, but you're wearing a cap and not a kippah. I said, in 2030, I'll be, if I'm alive, 80 years old. I don't have time for that. So, and I think that's really the role of NGOs like the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Business people don't need anybody. They're making their own deals. The people who are involved, the governments who are involved in security issues, they don't need NGOs. Where NGOs could make a difference is in normalizing the interchange between individuals and cultures and faith leaders and communities. When you could do that, as the UAE has, for as an example, that gives a much stronger base for normalization and real peace.
I think we can come to an end on that. Rabbi Cooper, thank you very much for taking, again, so much time to talk to us. It was a pleasure, as always. I hope we'll get the opportunity to repeat speaking to others in the near future. Thank you very much.
All the best.
Eine Produktion von MENA Watch, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns. Eine Produktion von MENA Watch, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns.